Broadcasting from Manhattan Beach and the World Wide Web, you're listening to CHSR, HealthyLife.net.
As a service to our listeners, this program is for general information and entertainment purposes only. CHSRHealthyLife.net does not recommend, endorse, or object to the views, products, or topics expressed or discussed by show hosts or their guests. We suggest you always consult with your own personal, medical, financial, or legal advisor.
Welcome to CenterPoint. I'm your host, Dr. Ron Anbar. In this show, we will discuss ways that we can journey to our own centers. This can help us access our inner resources to improve our physical abilities and health, our mental strength, our emotional well-being, and our spirituality. And I'm so excited today to introduce our special guest, Penelope Holt, who is a marvelous author. Welcome, Penelope.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Let me tell the audience a little bit about you. You're the author of The Angel Scroll, which is an excellent book I just finished reading. But before that, you were born and educated in England and now lives in New York. She's a novelist, playwright, business writer, and marketing executive whose work has been performed at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, York Arts Center, and the New York American Folk Theater. In addition to writing fiction, including The Angel Scroll and The Apple, which is based on the controversial Herman Rosenblatt Holocaust romance, Holt is a prolific writer, editor, and co-author of nonfiction, including Seeing God's Work, The Story of the Harlem Gospel Choir, Emotional Intelligence at Work, and many other works. She's married with two children. Penelope, welcome.
Thank you, Ron.
The reason I was so intrigued with The Angel Scroll is it covers themes that I enjoy reading about, but in my work with hypnosis and talking to the subconscious, I've seen many of the themes in your book. And I'm really curious to hear how you came up with the ideas and that are in the book and find out what elements in your own personal life perhaps led to those ideas. So maybe we can start. Tell me, how did you get to be a writer? How did you get to this place in life?
I think I became a writer because I was a prolific reader as a child in England. Long summer holidays with a big stack of books from the library, just reading everything I could get my hands on, you know, Dickens, Thomas Hardy, Jane Austen, Tolstoy, the greats. And then I did a degrees in linguistics and literature and would read these great stories and think, I'd love to do that. That's what I want to do. I want to transport people in their imagination the way, you know, I've been enriched by the authors that I've read. So I've been, as a playwright in college and thereafter when I first came to New York, I had a great time, but it's very difficult to make a living as when you're getting started. So I wound up going into advertising and marketing, because, you know, I joked, if I can't write the great American novel, at least I can write the copy on the back of cereal boxes, and keep writing, which if you want to write, you do have to write day to day. And then just as, you know, my kids got older, I really settled back down into writing novels. I've done a lot of business writing, co-authored books and ghostwritten books. But when you're, you know, when you're helping someone else to write a book, it's their work, it's their ideas. So The Angel Scroll, like you, Ron, it's got all of the themes and the metaphysical and spiritual and fringe religious theories that I find fascinating, so I finally settled down to write the book that I wanted to read.
Wonderful. So I counsel a lot of teenagers and young adults, and so some of them want to become creators of music or writing, and I think what you said is really important, that you can't start off writing the great American novel. You have to do some other stuff, and so you did advertising at the same time.
Yeah, advertising and editorial, PR and, you know, video script writing and helping other people to write their books. just finding opportunities to write every day. Because if you're focused on a bestseller, you may get lucky, you may win the lottery, you may play for the NBA, but the odds are kind of stacked. So the best thing that you can do is just write every day, build a portfolio, and now with the internet, people can write a blog. They can, you know, set up their own blog posts and start writing about the things that interest them. And now that publishing has been democratized, people and self-publishing is actually becoming, emerging as a better route to go for some people. You can self-publish very easily and sell your book on Amazon along with all of the, you know, great authors that are published through major houses. So I think it's getting easier now to be a writer. We don't have agents and publishers gatekeeping. I mean, there are people who've got great ideas and great stories but never see the light of day because, you know, they just couldn't get breakthrough and get an agent or get a publisher. So my advice would be, you know, as I tell my kids, 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration.
How do you deal with writer's block? You don't know what to write about if you're trying to write every day.
Well, I think when you write every day, I once heard a great chef from Lutèce. Someone said you're a you're an artist. And he said, I'm not an artist, I'm a craftsman. An artist can, you know, play around and get it wrong, but a craftsman has to get it right every time. Every time I cook a meal, I have to deliver for the customer. So I think you have to see yourself as a craftsman who practices your craft, and whether you feel like writing or not, just sit down and write. Ernest Hemingway famously, I think, got up at 5 or 6 o'clock every morning and wrote 300 words. Sometimes he wrote many more, but his commitment was to writing 300 words, which is a small paragraph. And what he figured out was, you know, there's a lot of inertia behind it, not writing. You put it off, you don't feel like it. But by having that appointment with his typewriter every morning at 5 or 6 a.m. and saying, if I only write 300 words, I'm still going to do it. And then, of course, when the inspiration takes hold and you get into it, and one thought leads to another, before you know where you are, you could have written thousands and thousands of words. So that's what I would recommend. Just make a commitment, sit down, and write, just say even 100 words, 200 words, 300 words, and then let the idea and the writing flow.
Now, AI has come on the scene, and I'm, how does that affect your writing? I know there's some junk stuff written by AI now available for sale, but like, do you use it at all? How does it affect you?
No, not for creative writing, because I think the creative writing is very, it's got to come from inside you. It has to be emotional and evocative and really connected to, you know, your deepest ideas. I think in business, there's some utility, not to just summarize things, or AI is quite good for, you know, people who are in social media world and they're putting out a message to different segments. It may be going to teenagers, it may be going to moms, it may be going to college students. And, you know, AI will help you add color or tone to sort of, you know, get that message aligned with, you know, with your target audience. So, and I think it's a fantastic research tool. I wish I'd had it when I was writing The Angel Scroll, because you can literally type in a question, you know, tell me about Jesus in India, which is, you know, a theme that I have in the book that, you know, the claim that Jesus in his hidden years traveled to India. And you know, ChatGPT will just spit out, it'll just aggregate and spit out all of the information on that. So I think for a writer, it's a fantastic research tool.
Yeah, I'm old enough that when I started writing for the medical literature, I would go to the library and look through card catalogs to find things.
I did too. Decimal system.
Yep.
And out of a library card, an out-of-date set of Encyclopedia Britannica.
There you go. Kids these days have no idea what we're talking about, the foreign language.
There was a funny meme or video, it was quite a few years ago. they gave two teens a rotary dial phone and said, here. And then they filmed them just like picking up the receiver and like playing with the, and just like the unfamiliarity with it, which, you know, every generation has that. My grandmother used to wash with a tub and, tub and postle, I think it was. You know, she'd fill the tub, a round tub with water, and then she'd put in like that little cross stick and, you know, move, agitate it to make the, you know, make the clothes go around and wash them. You know, we haven't seen anything like that for, you know, probably 70, 80 years, but.
Yep.
Technology marches on.
Things do change. The books like the Angel Scrolls sort of take us back thousands of years. So let's dig into the subject matter. So what experiences do you have in your own life that made you interested in this kind of topic?
Well, I've always been, I was baptized a Catholic in grammar school, convent school, at the age of 13. So I was sort of a new convert. Well, yes, a new convert. My parents had never baptized me. So I went into it full bore and really got a lot out of it, really learned a lot, went on pilgrimages, really enjoyed the liturgy of the Mass and the you know, the moral framework and the focus on others. I found it was a really good, laid down a good base. And then as I got older and I moved to America, you know, New Age things were very popular and I was curious. You know, I looked into all kinds of things. I looked into Buddhism and Hinduism and just became fascinated by how people come to God and what they believe. You know, taking away judgment, just really when people leave sort of spiritual and moral lives and aim for the highest good, you know, what got them there? So, that, you know, I did a lot of research on that. And then as I was researching the Dead Sea Scrolls, which were written by the Essenes and around this time of the Second Temple, I began to see how Christianity and Judaism and even Hinduism and Egyptian mysteries share a lot of history and a lot of threads and a lot of cultural overlap. So I find that very interesting to sort of go outside your, you know, your own boundaries of your faith, which is wonderful. I think people who are committed and they go to church and they really focus on their practice, I think that's a good thing to do. I think there's, you know, there can be a problem if you're just chopping and changing and, you know, trying different things on. But I don't think it's a bad idea to be, you know, to be curious and to enrich your own understanding of religion and spirituality in general.
You said you went on pilgrimages. Where did you go?
Went to Lourdes, which is in France, in the foothills of the Pyrenees, which is where Bernadette of Lourdes saw the Virgin Mary, and they built a grotto there. There's waters which are the sick go there for healing, basically. They believe that if they drink the water or are blessed with the water or worship there, that they will be healed. And whether you believe that or not, we know that there's a tremendous value in placebo effect. We know, you know, when they are experimenting or doing trials on medication, there's a 30% placebo effect with the control, with the water pool. So I've seen people just become so uplifted and so inspired and so moved by being there that it may not cure them ultimately, although there are, you know, the Catholic Church does investigate miracles. And when you go to Lourdes, there are crutches, you know, hanging there in the grotto. There are paraphernalia of people who have allegedly been cured and, you know, kind of thrown down their crutches. So but it's a beautiful place. I mean, the last time I went was years and years, and it's been sort of overtaken by a tourist trade, which is, you know, always happens, but it's a special place.
Yeah, just to underscore, placebo doesn't mean fake. Placebo is a real reaction, and people do get cured by placebos, and we don't understand the mechanism, but presumably it's not because of a drug. Presumably people's expectations, but who knows? It's something like Lourdes, if there's energy, or who knows? How old were you when you went there?
I was 14 and 15 when I went.
And how did you feel when you were there? Was it a different feeling or?
Yeah, it definitely, I think when people gather in a place like that with uplifting intentions and a lot of prayer, I think it definitely creates an energy. If you're Christian or anybody, you know, whatever your faith is, when you get to a religious holiday, say Christmas, you know, they say peace on earth and goodwill to all men, and you're walking around and the lights are on and, you know, people are smiling and they're sort of wrapped up with the spirit of the season, and you can feel it. It's just sort of a, you know, a unifying thing. And so when you go to Lourdes, similarly, you know, everybody's there. They're bringing sick people. They've got a lot of hope. There are people there, you know, that are there to serve. Our job was to, you know, it's very hilly there because it's in the foothills of the Pyrenees, and they put the, put some of the crippled people or sick people who were, you know, not well enough to walk in these sort of like little rickshaws, and it was our job to sort of transport them down to the grotto. And I had quite a large German nun in mind, and I was probably only weighed a buck at the time. You know, I was just a skinny 15-year-old trying to navigate this rickshaw down this cobbled hill down to the grotto, and I thought, oh my Lord, I'm going to have a runaway nun, because it was just the weight of it coming down. So got back to the hostel that night, and I had bruises all over my back, you know, just from trying to control this nun in a rickshaw. But it's, you feel you're part of something, and you feel like you're doing something good.
Yeah, that does echo what people feel on holidays. Actually, as you telling the story, I was thinking of 9/11, interestingly, and the day after 9/11, when America came together, which I think the last time we did, it felt that togetherness was there. It's really interesting.
Yeah.
That was a tragedy, obviously, but togetherness was there. I wish we could go back to that togetherness, without a tragedy. So you mentioned earlier, you talked about people's different ways of approaching God. Can you tell me, what is God in your mind? What does that mean?
Well, I've become very interested in metaphysics and new science. And quantum physicists and philosophers are sort of approaching, coming closer to spirituality, in they believe that consciousness itself, we experience everything through consciousness. You know, when we look out into the world, we don't see the thing itself. We see what's filtered through our perceptions through consciousness. So they're beginning to believe that consciousness is what's called the ontological primitive, which is that everything is unified and everything rises from consciousness. And although we have these divisions, we think we're in our own bodies and our own minds, we're actually sharing a mind at large. So there is no division. There's just this perception of division. And a lot of really serious thinkers and heavy hitters are, you know, pursuing that. And I think quantum physics is showing that, you know, space-time disappears at something like 10 to the minus 35, that things get tinier and tinier and tinier, and then they just sort of disappear into fields of energy. So I think that's an explanation that I have, that I'm just, nothing is out there outside of me, but I'm just sort of part of it and perceiving it. I think that is common across Eastern traditions. I like the Mass, the liturgy of the Mass. I think it's transcendent, and you go into a beautiful church and there are beautiful paintings and it's peaceful, and you know, you pray, and I think that is very uplifting. It puts you in, you know, there's a reason that we have these experiences together. I've been reading Stephen C. Meyer, who is a philosopher of science. He's written, if your readers are interested in them, he's written two really good books called Signature in the Cell, which is looking, when they mapped the genome and decoded and looked at DNA, they said it has been programmed. You know, it's, the genome is programming. And if there's a program, then there must be a programmer or a designer. So, he he believes in God, but science doesn't take into account a supernatural creator. It really focuses on just empirically what can be observed and measured in nature. So when you do that, you're taking a lot of things off the table, which I'm not bashing science, but I do think that Meyer is, you know, bringing some important, how do you measure something that is supernatural? You know, how do you measure something that goes beyond material things that you can see? So it's exciting that science and philosophy, and I think new generations of young scientists coming up, I think they're really moving in some fascinating directions to bring religion and, you know, physics and metaphysics closer together.
It's lovely to hear your description, because I'm in the midst of conducting interviews of subconscious of individuals. Most of them are young people, and they echo the same kind of themes, although they have not been learning it forever. So it's fascinating to hear the same story over and over again in different ways. I think of different religions as trying to describe the elephant, you know, the blind man describing the elephant. Everyone sees a different part of it, but still a greater whole, and that's, I think, what's happening. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, when I was a kid in Sunday school, the first place I went was the Salvation Army. There was a little Salvation Army hut down the lane from me, with the ladies with their tambourines and their big black bonnets. I was just fascinated. And the Sunday school teacher there talked about different religions and said, it's the same view from different windows. And that always stuck with me.
I love it. We're talking with Penelope Hope, the author of The Angel Scroll. This is Centerpoint with Dr. Ron Unbar.
Coming attraction, Life Guide for Teens, Harnessing Your Inner Power to Be Healthy, Happy, and Confident. A new book by Dr. Ron Unbar to be published early 2025. Dr. Ambar's renowned counseling practice, Centerpoint Medicine, doesn't fix teens who are struggling. They give them the tools to heal themselves and support them while that healing happens. Life Guide for Teens will share Dr. Ambar's tools for self-empowerment and give teens hundreds of tips to choose from to help themselves heal. The book will be available from Amazon and wherever fine books are sold.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Healing and changing children's lives with hypnosis is very real and very possible. Dr. Ron Ambar's new book, Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis, provides you meaningful stories and expert explanations to show you not only the process of hypnosis, but its many benefits for overall wellness. Whether a parent, practitioner, or medical doctor, this book opens the way to complete connection, so necessary for healing. Get your copy of Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis at Amazon.com or visit DrAnbar.com.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Dr. Ron Unbar and his dedicated team of healthcare providers offer unique health services to help patients overcome psychological roadblocks or use the power of their minds to improve their overall health and well-being. At Centerpoint Medicine, with services in La Jolla, California and Syracuse, New York, this caring staff are waiting just to help you. Find out more at CenterpointMedicine.com. Can't wait? Make your appointment now. Call 858-201-4001. That's 858-201-4001.
Audiobooks gives you instant access to over 50,000 of the bestsellers and hottest book titles in romance, mystery, fiction, and many other genres. Just visit HealthyLife.net's advertiser page and click on Audiobooks to get started.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
If you are a medical or licensed healthcare professional or just anyone looking for a qualified hypnosis practitioner, then go on over to ASCH.net. That's the American Society of Clinical Hypnosis. At ASCH.net, you can get certified, attend workshops, and even find a hypnosis practitioner or consultant. ASCH provides an opportunity to learn and interact with colleagues. So whether you're a professional wanting to learn hypnosis or a patient wanting help with a problem, visit ASCH.net now.
More exhilarating talk. HealthyLife.net.
Welcome back to Center Point. I'm your host, Dr. Ron Unbar, a special guest, Penelope Holt, author of The Angel Scroll that's available on Amazon and probably your local bookstores. We're talking about Penelope's background to the book. We talked about God. Now, in your book, the protagonist has a lot of visions. I'm wondering, have you had visions, or where did you come up with that?
I've had, I studied lucid dreaming for a while and Buddhist dream yoga, because the Buddhists believe that when we, the life is almost like a waking dream, that we're interpreting the outside world based on deep, unconscious, psychic and archetypal patterns, you know, the world of forms. So we look out there, we don't see the thing itself out there, we interpret it into these forms. And so that life, you know, waking life is almost like a persistent, stable, consensual dream that we kind of relate to in the same way, although there are massive differences between, you know this, Ron, there's massive differences between people. Even if you're married to someone for decades like I am, you still never really, really know that person, but you sort of share this consensual reality with them. But then when you dream, the dream is a little more uncontrolled. You know, the unconscious material is breaking through, and it's very symbolic in nature. And so I've had, you know, I've studied my dreams for years, got into the habit of remembering them and writing them down, and also having lucid dreams, which people, even without training, will have intermittently. And it's those dreams where you're actually awake in the dream and you know that you're dreaming and you're watching it. And if you, I'm trying to think of the guy that is, talks about dying as just waking up from another, waking up from a dream, waking up from a dream into another dream. I can't remember the, Rupert, it'll come to me. So, not visions in that sense, but a lot of dream work and symbols, synchronicities, the kind that Jung talk about, where you're talking about something or someone and an object will appear, or you're thinking about someone and they call you, or you have a strong sense that someone is thinking about you, either in a good way or a bad way. So I've worked, I've worked at really acknowledging and building that sense of intuition and knowing, because we know that, you know, I believe the gut has a second brain. There's all of these nerves, big part of your nervous system down in your gut. So that is the origin of people saying, I have a gut feeling, which is tacit data, you know, millions of pieces of tacit data that we take in over a lifetime that sort of will influence a feeling of knowing or recognition or understanding, right? And I think we're foolish not to take that stuff seriously, to just be very materialistic about the whole thing and mechanistic. I think there's way more going on than we, than most people understand.
When you lucid dream, how do you get into that state? Is it something you do?
Yeah, you have to. I haven't done it in a few years, but there's a meditation that you do. If people look into dream yoga, I think the Buddhists have the best techniques at it. The Buddhists are very good with mind training and really understanding the mind and how we cognize, and you know how consciousness flows from you know, sleep to dream to waking. They call the between states the bardos, and you know you have the bardo of death, which is you know the body dies and then you go into this the bardo of death, and then you know consciousness reemerges. But they have, if people want to pick up a book on dream yoga, there's a step-by-step guide on how to do the breathing and the meditation and really practice so that you start to have, build up that awareness while you're asleep.
Wonderful. So another theme in your book, besides the visions, is the theme of fate. So in the book, without revealing too much of the plot, there's a prediction that takes place 3,000 or 2,000 years ago, and then comes to pass. Do you believe in fate? Is that how you think of the world?
Fate? Again, I think it comes down to sort of unconscious drives that almost mathematically will predict things. And so in the book, an old Dead Sea Scroll called the Angel Scroll which actually they thought was real. It emerged in the 1990s as a lost Dead Sea Scroll. They saw drawings of it and actually found it, but it was allegedly written by Yeshua, the priest, and Yeshua is the name for Jesus, you know, the Savior, Yeshua the priest, and it was a tour of heaven. And I just took liberties. I really liked the idea of a scroll being found on the cusp of a new millennium, and I thought, wouldn't it be great if it had healing prophecy in it, you know, and was, everyone was terrified of Y2K and technology and nuclear weapons. Wouldn't it be great if there was this miraculous, something miraculous occurred? And so in the book, in the novel, I took artistic liberty, and the scroll predicts three miraculous paintings that heal when you put them together. And, you know, art was a big part of the Renaissance period. Before people could read, they understood the stories of Jesus and his church by going to church and seeing the beautiful iconography and the, you know, beautiful paintings. What's his name? Big famous Italian sculptor. Did the Dome of St. Peter Basilica. Famously worked the Sistine Chapel. Did the Sistine Chapel.
Michelangelo,
yes. Famously, yeah. You know, worked for the church. Worked, you know, a lot of artists at that time, their patrons were the church, and their job was to sort of tell the story of the Bible, this magnificent, you know, epic works of art and murals. And, you know, there's a point in the book where you look forward with insight, you know, if you can understand the patterns, and maybe it's not so hard to predict. I mean, this book is out, I don't know if you're aware of it. It came out a while ago called The Fourth Turning. I think the guys who wrote it did it in about 1998, and it predicted sociologists. It predicted the crash on Wall Street, the economy, the market collapsing. It predicted the pandemic. And it says that, you know, we go through this fourth period, which is the four turnings occur over about 80 years with each generation lasting about 20. And it's just a cycle of, you know, good times. They get too good. They get too stable. People forget. And then you start going into bad times. And then you get a lot of chaos. And then you get the unraveling, which is the social discord. And if we're not careful, you know, war and conflict. So the point being that just by studying sociology and patterns in history over time, these guys were really able to just, you know, come up with a theory that there are four turnings, and they're generational, and each generation inherits what the generation before has done, good or bad. After the war, you know, my parents were the greatest generation. My dad worked in the war, so England, you know, it was rough after the war. I think they had rationing until 1953, but after that, it, you know, it was rebuilt. We had the, you know, and we were able to, we had peace and stability, which we call the peace dividend, right? So many, younger generations have gone through their own struggles with, like you say, 9/11 and the market crash. But, you know, my parents knew what it was to be in the war and to cower, you know, in air raid shelters with bombs being dropped overhead and really, you know, convinced that the Nazis were going to be able to, you know, storm England like they had Poland and France, and, you know, all bets were off. So it's, you know, it's just easy to see how generations go through different things and how you can predict that over time.
You're sort of saying fate is a cycle. If you follow the cycles, you can sort of tell what might happen.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you've got this sort of finite behaviors that society is, they say that technology, you know, progresses in a linear fashion, but that human history is cyclical. And I think what's scary about that is the weapons are getting more powerful, but the people are repeating old patterns.
That's our fate, perhaps. We're talking with Penelope Holt, author of The Angel Scroll. This is In a Point with Dr. Ron Anbar.
May Make-A-Wish has been granting life-changing wishes for children and families for over 40 years. A wish is something that gives children the opportunity to look outside their illness and restore a sense of childhood back to the child. With the help of donors and more than 43,000 worldwide volunteers, Make-A-Wish has collectively granted more than 520,000 wishes worldwide. Dr. Anbar has referred many patients to Make-A-Wish. To make a donation, go to worldwish.org. That's worldwish.org.
HealthyLife.net, the positive radio network.
Healing and changing children's lives with hypnosis is very real and very possible. Dr. Ron Ambar's new book, Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis, provides you meaningful stories and expert explanations to show you not only the process of hypnosis, but its many benefits for overall wellness. Whether a parent, practitioner, or medical doctor, this book opens the way to complete connection, so necessary for healing. Get your copy of Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis at Amazon.com or visit DrAnbar.com.
Reach your health and fitness goals. Whether you want to lose weight, learn to dance, build muscle, or just live healthy, Beachbody gives you unlimited access to the nation's most popular fitness and weight loss solutions. Visit our advertiser page and click on Beachbody now.
Dr. Ron Ambar and his dedicated team of healthcare providers offer unique health services to help patients overcome psychological roadblocks or use the power of their minds to improve their overall health and well-being. At Centerpoint Medicine with services in La Jolla, California and Syracuse, New York, this caring staff are waiting just to help you. Find out more at centerpointmedicine.com. Can't wait? Make your appointment now. Call 858-201-4001. That's 858-201-4001.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Coming attraction, life guide for teens harnessing your inner power to be healthy, happy, and confident. A new book by Dr. Ron Ambar to be published early 2025. Dr. Ambar's renowned counseling practice, Centerpoint Medicine, doesn't fix teens who are struggling. They give them the tools to heal themselves and support them while that healing happens. Life Guide for Teens will share Dr. Ambar's tools for self-empowerment and give teens hundreds of tips to choose from to help themselves heal. The book will be available from Amazon and wherever fine books are sold.
All positive talk with a mature edge. HealthyLife.net.
Welcome back to Centerpoint. I'm your host, Dr. Ron Ambar. We're speaking today with Penelope Holt, author of The Angel Scroll. Before I forget, do you have a website people can find your book on?
Yes, thank you. If they go to Penelope Holt, that's H-O-L-T, don't ask me how to spell Penelope. Just kidding. PenelopeHolt.com. They can find some of the blogging and the book trailer and links to the book and my other books too.
Great. I urge you to check it out. Walk us through the process. You have these themes in your life. You've studied religion and approaches to God and visions and stuff, and you thought you wanted to write a book about it. How does the inspiration come? Does it come overnight? Like J.K. Rowling, suppose she was going on the train and the whole Harry Potter saga came into her mind. How did Angel Scroll get born?
Well, I give a lot of credit to Dan Brown and The Da Vinci Code, which I can't believe was written over 20 years ago. But I love that book. I just love the premise of these fringe religious theories of Jesus and Mary Magdalene being together and Opus Dei and, you know, all of the historic sites in England and France dating back to the Crusades. It's just a very, very sort of rich, symbolic history of religion. And he wove it all together into a great thriller, you know, with good versus evil. And it was sort of this rollicking ride around Europe with these sort of deep historical and cultural themes. And it always stuck with me. And I thought, you know, then I heard about this Dead Sea Scroll that was found, and I thought, scroll, prophecy, you know, what would the prophecy be? It would be great if it were paintings, going back to the Renaissance rather than the written word, which the reformers ushered in with the printing press. They really thought that Catholicism was, you know, idolatrous, and they wanted to get rid of all the clutter and have, and, you know, put the focus on reading the Bible. And, of course, the Bible became more available with the printing press. So the idea of the book was to cut away all of those interpretations and have a triptych of three paintings by three amateur artists. That's how you'd know that they were miraculous, because one of them is painted by a car mechanic, and it's like an old master. They're these magnificent paintings. And I think, you know, when we look at things, the beauty of nature or a sunset, we have that direct experience. You know, it opens our heart. And so the idea was that these three paintings could not just open the heart, but actually change the energy of the people that are looking at them. You know, that would be a good sort of idea of how you would affect a miracle. And then I just, all the stuff that I found fascinating, like Jesus in India and Glastonbury Tor in England, where the Druids enchanted the hillside. They would chant 24/7, which is the meaning of the word enchanting. It literally means chanting 24/7 to change the energy of a place. And then Jerusalem, you know, the old city of Jerusalem, which is so rich. So I just wanted to weave in all of the things that I read about and which fascinated me. And then the heroine, Claire Lucas, is a widow. Her husband has died at 38, and she's absolutely bereft. And I thought that's when people have those openings where they face those big existential questions of, you know, why am I here? Will I, you know, my loved one's gone. How will I go on? Will I ever see them? Is there something? Can I pull back the veil? So she's lost her husband, and she gets these visions. She has a dream, and she paints the dream, and it's a masterpiece. And then she gets pulled into the scavenger hunt. So it was kind of getting her situation as a young, mourning, grieving widow, and all of my sort of spiritual interests and inclinations, including psychology, Jung, archetypes, metaphysics, and then just kind of stealing from that Dan Brown and having the spiritual scavenger hunt be the kind of what drives the pace and the forward, and will they get the paintings, and if they do get the paintings, what will happen when they put them together, you know?
Did you know the end of the story when you started writing it?
I sort of, well, with what I set out to do, I sort of had an idea, but then you got to figure out the stops along the road, right? So as I was writing, I didn't do an outline. I tend not to. I do outlines when I do business writing, but with this, I would just write. I had a loose idea. I would write a chapter at a time. Then I go back and I polish the chapter so that I smooth it. It's like carpentry fine sanding. And then, then I'd wait, sort of like playing with ideas of what's going to happen next. So really, I lurched from chapter to chapter like that. And then I get an idea, and I say, oh, I'm going to build that in later. And, you know, Stephen King, talking about young writers, Stephen King wrote a really good book called On Writing, which is a biography combined with his approach as an author. And he talks about how he writes, his habits, you know, what he does. He says that he just writes the first draft flat out, rough, just stream of consciousness, just gets it all down on paper. And then he comes back and he sort of, you know, shapes it and he smooths it. But I tend not to do that. I do one chapter at a time and then wait for that second chapter to kind of emerge from the unconscious, because I think when we're working on a story, there's, you know, your unconscious is sort of sifting through all of the bits and then starts suggesting things to you.
I love how you describe it. So I have a tough question. So I've thought about this for a while. You know, the Bible has no illustrations. Like, I'm Jewish and we study the Old Testament, the Torah, and like there's a description of the tabernacle in words, and it's really hard to picture. I've seen drawings, somebody's drawing at it, but the writers of the Bible never drew an illustration. And I've wondered why, because, you know, they say a picture can be worth 1,000 words. Do you have any thoughts on that, given that you think illustrations are really important?
Well, when I was a kid in Sunday school, we had the children's Bible, which was illustrated. You know, you'd see the pictures of Jesus on the, giving the sermon on the mount, and the story of the prodigal son. So it was very pictorial. I think it's helpful. I mean, we know that some people are auditory. They learn by listening, and some people are visual, and some people are kinetic. You know, So if you're not someone who's great at studying words or, you know, reading the Bible, actually, I'm very auditory, so there's a great podcast called The Bible in 100 Days, which I downloaded the app last year, and it's really great. It goes through the Bible in 100 days, and it kind of walks you through start to finish. So I don't know, however people get the word, can receive it and receive the inspiration, I think it's all good. But to your point, maybe, you know, I think in, it's very mystical, the Jewish tradition. I'm sure that they've got some deep reasons as to why, you know, why they want you to focus on the words and use your imagination, or maybe have it come from some other place.
Maybe we'll explore that right after the break. We're running up against it. I'm talking with Penelope Holt, author of The Angel Scroll. This is Centerpoint with Dr. Ron Unbar.
More than 30,000 children and adults of every race and ethnic group in the U.S. have cystic fibrosis. Cystic fibrosis is a disease causing long-lasting lung infections, limiting the ability to breathe over time. Dr. Anbar participated in research that helped advance survival of cystic fibrosis patients by more than 20 years. He encourages you to donate to the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation to help find a cure. It's easy to donate. Go to cff.org. That's cff.org.
HealthyLife.net, the positive radio network.
If you are a medical or licensed healthcare professional or just anyone looking for a qualified hypnosis practitioner, then go on over to ASCH.net. That's the American Society of Clinical Hypnosis. At ASCH.net, you can get certified, attend workshops, and even find a hypnosis practitioner or consultant. ASCH provides an opportunity to learn and interact with colleagues. So whether you're a professional wanting to learn hypnosis or a patient wanting help with a problem, visit ASCH.net now.
Constant Contact and your small business make a perfect fit for marketing. They give you what you need to succeed. Fast and easy email marketing at your fingertips. Visit the HealthyLife.net advertiser page and click on Constant Contact to start your marketing.
Healing and changing children's lives with hypnosis is very real and very possible. Dr. Ron Ambar's new book, Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis, provides you meaningful stories and expert explanations to show you not only the process of hypnosis, but its many benefits for overall wellness. Whether a parent, practitioner, or medical doctor, this book opens the way to complete connection, so necessary for healing. Get your copy of Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis at Amazon.com. Or visit dranbar.com.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Dr. Ron Anbar and his dedicated team of healthcare providers offer unique health services to help patients overcome psychological roadblocks or use the power of their minds to improve their overall health and well-being. At Centerpoint Medicine with services in La Jolla, California and Syracuse, New York, this caring staff are waiting just to help you. Find out more at centerpointmedicine.com. Can't wait? Make your appointment now. Call 858-201-4001. That's 858-201-4001.
Radio your way. HealthyLife.net.
Welcome back to Centerpoint. I'm your host, Dr. Ron Anbar. Our special guest, Penelope Holt, author of The Angel Scroll, available on PenelopeHolt.com. We're talking about why there's no illustrations in the Bible. I've thought about this for a while, and I'm thinking that without illustrations, it makes people use their imaginations. And as we talked about the universe as a whole, that, you know, our consciousness interprets the universe in our heads, I think not having illustrations does not restrict us to somebody else's view. It gives us more latitude. That's the answer I've given myself. I don't know how you could weave it into the next. Are you going to write a sequel to Angel Scroll?
there's plenty of material and a really good story with a lot of good characters and threads. So, and people who have gone on an adventure. So, like Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. I think there's room for a sequel. But I like what you said about the Bible. I think too, you know, when you write a novel, you want the reader to create their own world and have you see the characters through their mind's eye in a way that they relate to well. So they'll look at Claire as this young widow and see her in a certain way. When you draw something, you certainly influence what people are looking at, and you kind of have, it's a gestalt, you know, you have a few pieces of information that create a whole picture inside. And so I think there's some, I don't think it's a mistake, I think there's something very profound in the Jewish faith about reading the words and relating to them either in a sort of a spiritual or an imaginative way. But it's a fascinating topic.
Maybe Angel Scroll 2, the triptych will change. It'll be different depending who looks at it. So just a thought.
I should run a competition and say, what, you know, what's the kicking off point for the next book? What do you think should happen? Should it disappear again? Should it be destroyed? You know.
Love it.
I know it's very popular for writers to get their readers involved. I'm not so good on that. I get so engrossed in writing that I, you know, sometimes forget the outside world. It's difficult to do. It's difficult to do both things: the writing and then the actual, you know, marketing of the book and interacting with the readers.
Yeah, as I've learned, marketing is a whole different profession than writing.
I can do it for other people. It's pretty difficult to do it for yourself. It's just, you know, that old cobbler's children have no shoes. The thing that you do for other people that you're good at, you tend not to represent yourself.
Yes. So in our last segment, I usually ask our guests to give us three tips based on their life experience that our listeners could put in today into their lives to help improve their life experience. Would you have any tips to share with us?
Yes. I think have very purposeful, one thought leads to the other, and you know, being bereaved, losing people that I love very, very dearly has been a painful. To love greatly means to grieve terribly. And I, you know, what I found in those times, I have to consciously, when you're in hard times, you have to consciously have an uplifting mantra. And mine is, I want to live with gratitude and acceptance and optimism and purpose. And I think if you say, tell yourself that, and there's a great series by Brian Tracy called Psychology of Achievement, and how important it is to put in the right, you know, if it's all, I can't do it, I can't bear it, I can't go on, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. The other thing I think about when, you know, look in the past and why didn't this happen, or why didn't I say this, or why did I do that, or did that person do it to me, understanding that we're all products of our environment, we're all conditioned to a certain extent to think and do what we do, and say what we say, that the definition of forgiveness that I heard that helps me very much is, forgiveness is understanding that it could not have been any other way. And that, I think, helps you, not that you shouldn't reflect or that you shouldn't learn or that's the lesson that you need to move you forward, but most people, when they look back on something, they understand that maybe they had a bad temper and they wound up hurting somebody and they really didn't mean to, and it's a wake-up call maybe to get that temper under control or whatever it is. But I think it stops you from torturing yourself. And then, you know, when I was a kid, my mom would tell me something, and I thought, I was 15, 16, I knew everything, and I was so much smarter than my mother. But she always used to say to me, think happy thoughts. And I think, and as I've gotten older, I believe that is true. There's a lot of negativity in the world. There's a lot of runaway emotions. Think happy thoughts. Put your mind on everything that is good and beautiful about life and this world and the people in it. And I think there's a kind of a meme or a trope on the internet now where people say, go touch grass. And that means get away from all of this noise and go outside and touch grass and remember what's important.
I love it. Can you repeat the mantra for us again slowly so people can register it?
Today I want to live with gratitude, acceptance, optimism, and purpose.
Gratitude, acceptance, optimism, and purpose. I'm repeating it because I think that's great. I think people should commit it to memory. That's a great tip. So the book is published. Is there anything you wish you had done differently with it?
Oh, you always wish that. You know, I went through the book, and every time I found a change, I would go back through it again. I said to my husband, was like, you've got OCD, you're out of control. And I said, nope, I don't want to leave anything on the field. But even now, I read it, and I'm like, I want to change that. Oh, no, I don't like that. I wish I said that differently. I'm an amateur painter. I had an amazing art teacher who was in her 80s. She was wonderful. And she used to say it's the dissatisfaction of the artist. And she told me about this French painter who once broke into an art gallery in France and so that he could touch up his painting because he just wasn't satisfied. So, you do the best you can. It's like forgiveness, right? It couldn't have been any other way. You do the best you can at the time, and then you learn, and you just keep going. So make it better next time.
Speaking of art, can you say quickly something about the book cover? Did you design it? Did the publisher design it?
Well, very often publishers don't let you design your own cover. They're like, no, it's okay. We'll take it from here. And, yeah, they have a lot of marketing data that tells them what sells. But in this case, because it was spiritual, they asked me to pick an image. And this is a sacred geometry. I think it's the seed of life. And at the center of it is the Vesicapiscus, which is very important symbol, features heavily in the book in sacred geometry. It's the shape of the eye where two circles intersect. They make that eye shape. It was the fish that early Christians knew each other by. And so I love this image, and then I think the cover designer just incorporated it and did a beautiful job.
Penelope Holt, thank you so much for all you shared with us. Your book is The Angel Scroll, available at Amazon and bookstores. Maybe we'll have you back in another few months. You can tell us what happened. Did you find the real scroll? Thank you again for joining us. This is Centerpoint with Dr. Ron Anbar.